Welcome to The Twelfth Story, a podcast from the Mercantile Library, where readers have gathered since 1835 to connect, debate, and discuss. On today's episode, we're talking about stories with staying power, specifically the 1001 Tales from Arabian Nights. I'm book advisor Hillary Copsey, and joining me today are Joe Hyde, a member who recently led the library's discussion of the newest translation of the Arabian Nights, and Stephen Yandell, an associate professor at Xavier University with an expertise in medievalism and popular culture. Starting in September, Steve will be leading a discussion series called Epicish that will consider centuries-old poems, Beowulf, and Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. Joe and Steve, welcome. So Joe, you chose Arabian Nights for our latest In Pieces discussion. This is a series where we tackle these big, important books together for accountability and all those good things. You picked the newest edition of these very old tales, a translation by Yasmin Seal of stories originally published in Arabic as well as ones originally published in French. So what drew you to this book? Why did you pick it?
Yeah, the Masterpieces series has been terrific in my view. It's one of the reasons I love the Mercantile. But we have been focused really on the Western canon, Western including Russian and other, in Spanish as well as American. And we've made it through a lot of the great books that you think of as books you should have read in high school or in college or that you read the Cliff Notes for, and now it's a chance as an adult to dive in. But we hadn't really gone outside of the Western canon. And my thought was, there's the whole rest of the world. You know, there are the same foundational books in Chinese literature, in Indian literature, and in Middle Eastern literature. And I was thinking, why are we ignoring all that? There ought to be something we can read in that world. And then, lo and behold, I read a review in The New Yorker of this new edition that you mentioned, Hillary, and about how Yasmin Seal really brought, because she is both Arabic and French, she brought her expertise to this and a new way, new lyricism to the translation, which I found to be true, by the way, as we read through it. It was wonderfully translated. But also that the illustrations were phenomenal and that it was a new treatment of this. So I thought, why not? Like many of our listeners, I'm sure, I knew something about Ali Baba and Aladdin a little bit, but no idea what these stories really were and what was really in them. And so I picked up the book and looked at it, and it's physically beautiful, and it's huge, so it meets that criteria.
Yes, it is.
It's the kind of thing you're not just going to pick up and read maybe on your own on a weekend, and to have it done in community the way we do here and break it down into pieces and talk about it, I thought would be a nice addition and a rounding out maybe of what we've done otherwise in the group.
Yeah. So. I was really excited to do this because an author I had liked, I really enjoy her work, Shannon Chakraborty, had recommended it and these stories, both this translation and the stories in general, have inspired her books that are contemporary literature. I was surprised by how many pieces in the Western canon had been inspired by these tales. Like, I guess I should have known that, but I didn't. I'm curious, Steve and Joe, like, what surprised you as we dug into these stories? What were you expecting and what did you get?
I feel in exactly the same position that Arabian Nights was one of these works, you know, after being a lifelong reader, that had just slipped through the cracks. So I was so appreciative. Of course, I'm appreciative, both Hillary and Joe, to allow me to join this conversation. But to pick up that book, to pick up a book that has had these amazing illustrations that Joe and I know are going to stick with us. And it gave me new ways to appreciate things that are going on in the medieval literature that I study largely in England, Ireland, and Scotland. These tales that have these very common tropes, these very common elements that are made to communicate quickly and clearly a set of morals that need to be passed down to the next generation. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to read through that lens and see, this is exactly what cultures do. We're always doing this. What's important to us? How do we tell this over and over again?
Yeah, and this particular edition, for those who want to take a look at it, does have hundreds of pages of background that provide sort of the context for where this came from. And reading that and then reading the stories, you realize these stories were the origin of so much, both in literature but also just in our culture. You know, there would be no comic books without 1001 Arabian Nights, in my view. There'd be no, you know, episodic TV. I was just watching Ozark last night, and to end each episode with a cliffhanger that makes you want to watch the next episode. That came from Scheherazade here, you know, in the oral tradition even before it was written down. So, you know, thousands of years ago. So much of what we think of as literature and storytelling had its source here. And even these stories, as you learn in the accompanying material, had predecessor stories in Persia and in India and in China. We think of these as Arabic because of the title, 1001 Arabian Nights, but that's just where it sort of came together and started to be written down. But these stories have origins even before that. So it literally goes back as far as one can try to go back on our ability to tell stories and to gather and get people's attention and to bring fantasy and magic and exoticism. You know, the idea that there are places in the world where almost anything can happen. I think about how many stories you read where that's the case, or how many TV shows you watch where, whether it's Stranger Things or otherwise, there's one town there where anything can happen. You know, it's that came from these stories too. These stories often go off into a strange world where anything can happen, where there's genies and there's magic. You know, all that comes from here.
Yeah.
So
it was interesting I didn't pick this on purpose, but right after you chose this and we were preparing for the discussion, I picked up a nonfiction book called The Bright Ages, which kind of reframes that period we think of as the Dark Ages, right? The medieval times. And the whole premise of this book of history is that that's a very Eurocentric way of looking at that time. Mm-hmm. And that if you look a little bit farther east, this was actually a very multicultural time. The people were moving a lot. People in that center, in the Middle East, there were people coming from everywhere, really. It was a central place. And that's where these tales started getting written down. And that it was such a happy accident to be reading these books at the same time, because I could see what the history was and how it was playing out in these stories. I mean, Aladdin, for instance, is set in China. Like, mm-hmm. we think of this as this, you know, set in Saudi Arabia or something, right? This Middle Eastern story. But Aladdin is actually set in China in these stories.
And several of the other stories are set in Persia or in other parts of the world that are, again, exotic for the reader or the listener. Again, these were oral before they were written down. The listener in Egypt or in some of them were from Aleppo. You know, and that part of it also was what our introductory session here, we had a professor emeritus from Ohio State, Dr. Sabra Weber, came and talked to us, and she helped set that same point, Hillary, about how geographically diverse these stories are and about how you need to think of them as traveling all across not just the Middle East, but all across the Mediterranean environment, mm-hmm. and the way oral traditions happen and the way the merchant routes and the Silk Route and everything, that these stories are traveling. And some of them do seem to be set in Cairo. Some do seem to be set in Iraq or seem to be set in Aleppo. But others are meant to be set in China or Persia or other places. And that's a function of what's going on at the time. It was the height of trade in and around the Middle Eastern world. But also that's where the origins of these came from. And that's why some of these stories actually do have more Chinese or Indian origins than Arabic. But they came into Europe as Arabian stories, and so that's kind of where a lot of the story starts for us Western readers is when it was translated into French by Galland, which is covered at length in this book, and then it became across Western Europe and England, came into England, and that's obviously hundreds, thousands of years after the stories were originally circulated.
Yeah, I think that's something that this translation does a really good job of, is sort of explaining the history of these stories, too. Mm-hmm. To your point, Joe, about all the extra material in this book, it's called The Annotated Arabian Nights. There are a lot of annotations. There's also a lot of forward material. But it does a good job of explaining how. So there's the origin of the tales in this multicultural, very ancient world, right? People moving and traveling, and then written down in French around the time of the French Revolution, and then coming into Europe from there. And, you know, writers like Dickens and all these other, they did learn storytelling methods, the cliffhanger, the episodic stuff. All of that comes from these stories. It was really fascinating for me to think about how the tales had moved through time and both served a purpose, but were also changed by that time that they were being translated. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, you know, why you guys think that these stories stayed Like, they did travel through time. They were able to do that, and they were changed through that. But why did they get moving in the first place, right?
You raise a really interesting point that as these cultures are interacting with each other, I guess I would argue there's a kind of dual aspect going on, one which is reading other people's stories allows us to be reminded we're all alike. We have some of these common values. It shouldn't be so simple, but don't kill other people, stick to the promises you make and the vows. But there's also, we're equally intrigued by this exoticism that you're pointing to. How are things, what's one supposed to do if one's brother's wife needs to be remarried? What are my duties? And those don't quite align so much with us. And what I'm struck by is this technique that I see in other medieval literature, and we certainly see in Arabian Nights, which is this multi-level narration, which provides a kind of safety net. So we were introduced to, here's the narrator of our story, who's then introducing a narrator who's telling stories which include multiple levels of narration, so that one walks away saying, oh, I'm really interested in these stories. I can see myself in these places. These people are a little bit different, but you can't quite put your finger on who should I blame for this, what I either agree with or don't agree with, because you're many layers away of saying any one of these levels of narration can say, don't blame me. I'm just telling the story I heard.
I mean, Joe, mm-hmm. you counted at one point. We were like, what, 5 layers deep?
Yes.
Like 5 stories in? Mm-hmm. Yeah, a story within a story within a story. It was a little crazy and hard to follow sometimes.
And that was one of the many aspects that echoed for me of Don Quixote, one of my favorite stories we did, and I always reference where... In that tale, you are 3 or 4 or 5 layers deep at one point in that story. But yeah, the embedded tale within a tale within a tale comes from here. And I think you're right. It gives you a license to suspend all that disbelief and go with the notion that there is a genie who can just create things out of thin air and can pick up people and move them in time and space. And there's a carpet where if you sit on it, you're instantly transported somewhere else. And all these things can happen when you're that far deep into a story. And that notion of magic and fantasy also, I think, is part of the answer to your question, Hillary, because who wants to read just about normal, common things that happen to people? I mean, a lot of us like those kind of books too, but nothing wrong with a book where you can just dive in and you're somewhere else entirely and totally unexpected things are happening. Again, why do we think Stranger Things is at a season 4? It's because with every episode, you never know what's going to happen, right? And that's certainly the case here. You would turn the page and all of a sudden, something would happen that the fisherman all of a sudden outsmarts the genie, right? And there's a couple of those moments. And the other thing I will say about these stories is, we haven't seen this in some of the other literature we've read, is that they feature very powerful, strong women, including our frame story. I mean, our frame story sets up Scheherazade as the ultimate storyteller. She's telling all these tales in order to save both her life and the life of all the women in the kingdom. And unsurprisingly, maybe, our storyteller, who's a woman, tells stories about some very interesting, strong, powerful, sometimes deeply evil, women, which, again, thinking about how old these stories are, I think that was notable.
Yeah, I would agree with that. There are a huge variety of women in these stories. Like, it's not as binary as, like, the virgin and the whore or those sorts of archetypes that you get. I think you get a wider array of female characters in these stories, and they all have agency. Like, whether they're evil or whether innocent, it doesn't matter. Like, all along the way, even Scheherazade, like, she's actively disobeying her father to tell these stories, right? Mm-hmm. To save her kingdom. And so often I was struck by both Scheherazade in our frame story and in many of the other stories, it's women saving the day or reacting to kind of the petulance of a man, right? Like, it's not even like a big heroic gesture or a major mistake. It's just like, I'm angry right now, right? You brought this up a lot in our discussions, the sort of rash decisions. Like, rash decisions will always get you in trouble.
Which makes sense for Scheherazade to be telling stories with that theme because she's trying to save herself. But it came up over and over again. And also... speaking of women with agency, if nothing else, you should pick this up to read the original Ali Baba story, which is not really about Ali Baba. It's about his servant slave woman who saves everything, saves Ali Baba, saves the day, ultimately marries. So there's a lot of that in here. There's a lot of the, and you know, one of the things we did with our reading groups over the course of our sessions together is ask people, what was your favorite story? What was your favorite character? Because it is like reading a series of short stories. There's sometimes some connection between them, but they're often entirely freestanding stories. I mean, Sinbad is in a group of stories, and then you don't really see him again, etc. And Ali Baba is one story, and Aladdin is one story. But almost our entire group loved Delilah. So there's a story about, it's very urban, not a lot of magic, no genies, but there's a very crafty urban woman named Delilah who, I don't want to ruin it for folks, but who's a joy to read about. It's one of the shorter stories in here, actually, but talk about agency. She's entirely the star of the show. She outsmarts everybody, including, I think, the caliph at one point, you know, the leaders. And that's another thing we talked about, is how the leaders come across in these stories, how the they don't always come across all that well. But Delilah sort of is a joy to read about. And that sprinkled in the middle of these thousand-year-old stories, I thought that was a surprise.
It was nice. And actually, that author that I mentioned, Chakraborty, she has said that she was... So the series that I read that I really liked is called... It starts with a book called The City of Brass, and the main character in that trilogy is this woman named Nari, and she was inspired by Delilah. She's this sort of very urban woman, crafty, and, you know, kind of smarter than everyone around her. Not always making the best decisions, though, right? So, and then
yeah, Delilah was a thief after all.
Exactly,
but anyway, she was really
right?
good at it.
And that's,
exactly.
I think, the real interesting negotiation to be reading, the real joy of reading some of these is watching an author figure out, how can I be subversive? How can I push the limit on what assumptions are for gender roles, but then also maintain a system that reinforces the status quo, kind of upholds traditional ideology, and to kind of push the needle forward a little bit. We see that in all sorts of medieval literature. Reproduces in some ways, Delilah reproduces all sorts of negative stereotypes. But I would argue, yeah, pushes the needle a little bit forward to say, here are the good things that, you know, we should understand this traditional role of woman can break out of the bounds that had been set.
Yeah.
And she ends up in pretty good shape, her and her daughter both, at the end of the story. So, anyway.
You mentioned the bounds of society, and we've talked a little bit about this, the sort of lessons that come out of these stories. They reminded, especially the French tales, reminded a lot of us of the fairy tales that we know, like Grimm's fairy tales. Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk a little bit about those lessons. Joe, you, I think, had a really great summary of, like, what can these stories teach us? Like, what were they trying to teach us? And then, Steve, I hoped you could talk a little bit about some of the similarities and differences between these stories and what they're teaching us and what our more traditional English stories and fairy tales might be teaching us.
Yeah, we did have a couple of sort of lessons that weren't all that subtle. Envy is bad. Almost everyone who's envious of someone else, really awful things happen to them. Excessive curiosity is a bad idea, too. Again, I was Sinbad, amongst others, who just couldn't be satisfied with what they had. And
serious
so
FOMO.
We talked about that. Way too many people who decided, I'm in great shape, but it's still not good enough. I got to go out and risk everything on foolhardy adventures that end up almost killing me and everybody around me. Another one was bad things tend to happen to those who go out on a hunt for a long period of time and leave everybody back home. Again, we've seen that in many, many Western stories, too. But there was a lot of that. And some of the lessons were about rashness and rash violence that we think Scheherazade was trying to tell the king Shahriar about not killing people after all. And some of it was about the competing intelligence of a genie versus humans. There's that going on, too, is... Genies with all their power and all their ability to just make things happen are often at the will of humans who rub the lamp and bring them forward or otherwise bring them forward. And also some humans outsmart them. So there's some of that too, but there's a lot, I think, particularly in the European translations and the French stories, there were some morals too about what, you know, bad leaders can really screw things up and they need to be saved by the common people, that common merchants who have the values of thriftiness and working hard and being honest do well. I mean, some of those, again, were not terribly subtle in these stories, but they came through.
And interesting when you think about the timing of those French tales, right? Mm-hmm. The publication of them right around just leading up to the French Revolution, right? Am I right on that time? Yeah, so don't know.
There's some narrative theorists who would also argue anytime we see these supernatural creatures, they're ultimately a way of talking about ourselves. I mean, we see that folks are talking about more recently vampires and zombies. What human aspect are we projecting onto these supernatural creatures? Which also makes me think of there's some slightly controversial values that are put forward to being clever is good, sometimes at the detriment of kind of how you treat other people. And that's one of the things that, that also reminded me, this discussion of leaders. There's a group that would argue these tales might have been most accessible to royal families, and they are passed down to train the upcoming princes of how to rule properly. So there's a lot based on what should a well-functioning society look like? How should that leader treat other people? But in this doesn't quite fit with Arabian Nights, but in the medieval literature, the English literature I look at, these basic building blocks of these narrative moral stories are so flexible that generation after generation, King Arthur is an example, we have this Celtic king who the primary focus is defending his people. And then after the Anglo-Saxon invasion, he becomes an Anglo-Saxon king who is defending. And then he becomes a Norman king. And then he becomes, it becomes this endlessly generative kind of sign system that reworks, that can be reworked by a good author to kind of retell these things of how do we hold ourselves together as a society? And it can be, you know, these little bits can be different, but we as an audience want to hear that over and over. Let's be reminded, what are those big stories of how we should survive?
I feel like you're perfectly queuing up the thing you keep talking about, Joe, which is the power of storytelling that comes through in these tales, right?
Yeah, and that's it's discussed in some of the other material in the book as well, but you obviously, the storytelling is keeping Scheherazade alive, and all of us readers along with her, and that inserts itself several times in these 800 pages. You're reminded that, okay, Scheherazade said that's where we're going to end for tonight, and stay tuned for tomorrow, and so she gets to live another day. So there's literally the power of her to keep herself alive and stop the evil king from murdering any more women, but beyond that, embedded within these tales over and over again is that power, and that's part of the reason why these stories, I think, have been passed down all this time. And we discussed in our last session the book Sapiens by Harari, who talks about what is it that allowed Homo sapiens, that particular humanoid species, to survive longer than and ultimately conquer stronger Cro-Magnon and some of these other names we put on these other these other human species were stronger. Some of them were physically bigger. They had just as big a brain. They're probably just as good at killing animals. But what was it about the Homo sapiens? And his theory is it was basically the ability to communicate common shared myths and to act on them, essentially storytelling. The ability to share stories, whether you call it religion or whether you call it myth or tradition, but the notion of being able to sit around the fire and talk about things that never occurred or that will only occur in the future, that aren't just here's how we hunt the mammoth tomorrow, but were literally imaginative stories, and the ability to communicate that and to act on it as a group is what allowed Homo sapiens to survive and ultimately be the only human species left. And so it's coded in our DNA, arguably, the power of stories, the importance of stories. And one of our other readers commented, well, that also might explain why it's changed so much. You know, these stories have changed over the years, just like DNA is changed over time, and that's how different traits and weaknesses arise in species, is the modification and the change of DNA. Is these stories are not what they were when they were told around Aleppo, you know, 1,000 years ago, but the core of them remains the same. And in that way, they maybe are like the passing down of human DNA.
I remember in our discussions as well, some of our tangents would include either, I can see where this story came from. This is one we tell over and over. Or here's where I most recently saw a modern version of this. We tell these stories over and over. I brought in what I think is an interesting quotation from C.S. Lewis. He does an overview of the medieval period in his book called The Discarded Image. And at the very end of this book, he challenges our understanding of what we even know as original in storytelling. This is what he says. Because in the Middle Ages, these stories are told over and over again. Lewis says, "I doubt if a medieval audience would have understood our demand for originality or valued those works in their own age which were original any more on that account. If you had asked Layamon or Chaucer, 'Why do you not make up a brand new story of your own?' I think they might have replied, in effect, 'Surely we are not yet reduced to that. Spin something out of one's own head when the world teems with so many noble deeds, wholesome examples, pitiful tragedies, strange adventures, and merry jests, which have never yet been set forth quite so well as they deserve. The originality which we regard as a sign of wealth might have seemed to them a confession of poverty."
Hmm. Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah. That notion of originality or authenticity came up right at the very beginning, where one of the questions was asked is, are these like truly authentic translations now, finally, by Yasmin Seal? And the notion was, you're kind of asking the wrong question. Well, what does authentic mean? She applied her own lyrical and, again, I think beautiful language to translate these for a modern audience in 2018, 2019 when this came out. And so it reads well for us. Is that authentic? It's the story that she's telling from the source material to us, and it reads beautifully. So in that regard, it's authentic. Is it the way it was told in Cairo thousands of years ago? Of course not. But does that mean that's the authentic one and this is not? You know, that's an interesting idea we played with as we looked at these translations as well.
When students read Beowulf in my class, that's one of the things we have to confront immediately, mm-hmm. that this is a story we know had been in circulation for hundreds of years. We know that through dialect, we know that the author is doing things that aren't quite what's happening in Anglo-Saxon at the moment when we know this manuscript was created. We have one version of this manuscript, one version of the story, and so that notion of, well, what really happened, what's authentic, is something we, is a very modern understanding of that we want to appeal to. And yet, as you point out, it's just an inappropriate question for these stories that have just infiltrated our lives over and over and have all these multiple versions. We're fortunate to have someone have compiled them, but that's just one of these versions.
It's also kind of an inappropriate question in general for humans. I mean, two people can watch the same exact thing and come away with entirely different stories. So, I mean, you see that in police investigations and all kinds of different places. I mean, Joe, you're a lawyer. I'm sure mm-hmm. this has come up in your profession on occasion.
There's only one version of the truth, Hillary. There's only one version of the truth.
If we reduce a story to facts.
Right.
But we're doing
and
more
than that.
And
what fun is that?
Right. And
yes.
So it's an interesting lesson for us all to go through, right? Mm-hmm. And an entertaining way to learn that lesson. Is to go
and when you
tales.
Talk about versions, one of the things we started with was all the different, Hillary had additional material she cited us to, was all the different versions of the Aladdin story from Scooby-Doo, through, there's a version of that, through Disney's, you know, famous one, which is nothing like the original.
No.
And I mean, what is the original? Well, you know, Disney's entitled to its own interpretation too, right? Even if it's nothing like the story in this book, where Aladdin murders multiple people for no reason other than greed. But anyway, not to ruin it for you, but it's not Disney, all right? But Disney did it just, so many different people have taken these stories as launching pads and just kept the core elements of magic carpets and open sesame, and all those things are in here, but
I'm sorry, Hillary.
Well, yeah. I was going to say, in whatever key element, key lesson they want to distribute, right?
Yes.
So, you know, in Disney, in America, you know, the idea of a street rat that can elevate himself through his noble demeanor, like, that's a very American story, right?
Mm-hmm. And I've read several pieces on the Disneyfication of a narrative. And to Disney's credit, they, I would argue, understand some of this medieval mindset. They are happy to pick up their own stories again. They wouldn't have done this a decade or two ago, but they are saying, let's retell Aladdin, let's do a live action version. Some would say this, again, is that inability to tell new stories. But these new versions, there are stage shows that are done in their theme parks and on their cruise ships. They're retelling Aladdin over and over again with different central themes. They're working different characters in and out. So I credit them with saying, we understand that we've done something for the mass culture that's different from what was there before, but we're going to keep playing with it.
Yeah.
Well, I would think if you had to ask an institution in America that understands the power of storytelling, Disney might be at the top of your list.
I would say so. So I want to end with a question that we always ask in the In Pieces discussions. So we always, almost always end our In Pieces discussions with this question. So those discussions are of big, important, often old books, things that are in the canon, whatever that means. And the question we always ask is this still relevant? Would you recommend this to someone today, right now, and why? So for you guys, you know, what do you think about Arabian Nights? Is it still relevant? Would you recommend it?
Why don't you go first? Because I think people are going to expect where I'm going to land, but go ahead.
Well, I guess I would argue a little bit in the same way that some would say what any character in a work is ultimately kind of talking about humanity and the culture's, the values of a particular culture. There's something, this is based largely in reader response theory, that when you go into a narrative, you're finding yourself there. Where do I fit in? What can I take away from this? How am I reading it? What's my context in this? And I would say that's, for me, at the heart, the beauty of stories, both understanding a culture better and understanding yourself better. We're a species hardwired for stories, and the more we can do that, the more we grow as human beings.
Yes. No, that's a great way to put it. George Saunders' latest book, a series of lectures actually, called A Swim in the Pond in the Rain, it develops this theory much better than I ever could. But the notion is the purpose of a good story, and he covers Russian literature, is to expand one's empathy in a dialogue with the author. And the idea is, did these stories do that? Well, they certainly expanded your mind. I mean, for me, I didn't come into Aladdin thinking it would turn out the way it did. I mean, these stories are interesting and fun to read for that standpoint. But also, you pick up references that continue to echo in current culture. If you watch Better Call Saul, which my wife and I do, we love Better Call Saul, one of the last episodes of this current group that came out involves a motif that came up in the second story here in The Fisherman and the Genie, which is you put a solution on a book. There was a poison that was put on a book, and the king read the book and it got it on his fingers and it killed him. Well, in Better Call Saul, they put a solution on a photograph that one of their that they got into the hands of the person they were trying to set up, and it made him appear to be hooked on drugs. And so these motifs reflect and they redound and they echo. In that regard, it's worth reading. But also, for me, it was worth reading because of being able to focus on what you were just talking about, which is to see, as many years ago as these oral traditions were created, these common themes that still are fun to read about and to place yourself into.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. Your guys' answers are making me think, like, perhaps here at the Mercantile, where we have a community of readers, it's the wrong question to ask, right? Of course, we all
buy
think,
in. We're
yes,
all in.
Yes, we are all in, and I certainly am. If anyone listening is of this ilk, we have more discussions for you, including the discussions that Steve will be leading starting in September. You can find that at themercantilelibrary.com on our calendar. It's called Epic-ish, and we'll be tackling the newest translation of Beowulf, as well as Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, and then watching The Green Knight, which was a movie based on that poem. So.
Which will benefit an audience being able to discuss it more widely. If you've seen the film or not seen the film, know that we'll show it here. But it's a film that will leave you scratching your head unless you get to talk to other people about it.
Well, we do love to talk here.
We do.
And we'll be doing lots more In Pieces discussions. We're not sure which book we're going to next, but we will definitely be diving in sooner rather than later. Well, thanks to Joe Hyde and to Stephen Yandell today, and thank you all for joining us on The 12th Story. To make sure you catch every episode, subscribe through iTunes or SoundCloud, and don't forget, your good words are better than any advertisement. If you like what you heard, tell your friends, share this episode. Today's podcast was directed and engineered by Chris Messick. Our theme music was created by Doug McDermott. The 12th Story is a production of the Mercantile Library in downtown Cincinnati. The literary center of Cincinnati, the Mercantile is a 187-year-old working library with more than 80,000 books available to members. The library organizes book discussion groups, writing workshops, and welcomes thousands every year to its author talks, lectures, and other civic events. Harriet Beecher Stowe and Herman Melville, Colson Whitehead, and Margaret Atwood all have spoken at Mercantile events. Visit us online at mercantilelibrary.com, where you can learn about and register for all our upcoming events, or stop by the library. We're at 414 Walnut Street in downtown Cincinnati, and we always welcome new members and guests. You belong here. Yeah.